Wednesday, June 28th, the organization NYC4CEDAW will host a day of action beginning in Brooklyn Bridge Park by walking across the bridge to the steps of City Hall in Lower Manhattan, where there will be a rally at noon with members of more than 200 local organizations and community groups. The objective, according to an official NYC4CEDAW, passed, quote, a Women's Bill of Rights, which honors and reflects the obligations outlined in the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women to properly support and fund programming to positively benefit women in all five boroughs. Find out more by sending an email to nyc4cedaw.info@gmail.com or by going to the website nyc4cedaw.org. On Sunday, July 2nd, New York City will join sister cities around the world to march for the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. Donald Trump has been in blatant violation of the Constitution from the day he was sworn into the office of president, reads the marchers' mission statement. It is time that congressional representatives do their job and start the process to impeach this president. We believe President Trump has committed constitutional breaches, consistently lied, cheated, and enforces laws that primarily benefit him and his billionaire friends at the expense of the country. The impeachment march begins at 11 a.m. at 61st Street and Central Park West. You can enter the park at 65th Street. For more information, go to impeachmentmarch.org. That's the WBAI Resistance Calendar for the week ending Saturday, June 24th. I'm Jesse Lent.
George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, was written as a warning. Today, it's used as a playbook.
Do you believe in God, Winston? No. Then what is it, this principle that will defeat us? I don't know. The spirit of man? And do you consider yourself a man? Yes. If you are a man, Winston, you are the last man.
Tune in Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour Pacifica National broadcast of our classic 1975 cover-to-cover marathon reading of 1984 on your Pacifica station. That's Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour marathon broadcast.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us in, about 5 minutes or so, Terrence Taylor. We're going to talk, about, let's call it, the new video series and stuff like that. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. So, finally, I did see Wonder Woman. And my reaction to it was the same as many hardcore Wonder Woman fans. Not enough bondage. But besides that, Google William Marston, you'll understand. Besides that, I'm kind of cheesed off because the thing that I found most interesting in the film, the thing that kind of encapsulates the long road this character took to getting to the screen, the fears and anticipation that accompanied finally having a female superhero take the lead of a major mainstream release, and the state of the DC cinematic universe as it was transformed by Chris Nolan and Zack Snyder, I can't talk about that thing because it involves a major plot spoiler. So I'm going to talk around it, and if you've seen the film, you'll hopefully figure out what I'm trying to say. If not, maybe it'll sound like complete gibberish, but hopefully you'll understand once you've seen the film. And you should see the film, by the way. Director Patty Jenkins delivers a fine exercise that reconnects to the joy of superhero films that recent DC movies seemed to have abandoned. But there is this thing that happens at the end of the film that is a serious break with Wonder Woman canon as it exists elsewhere. And it is something that Zack Snyder, who produced this film, and Chris Nolan, and actually quite a number of superhero films beyond them, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 played this card as well, resort to. And when it happened, I wasn't profoundly angered by it, but I did go, well, do I detect the hand of Zack Snyder here, getting all iconoclastic again in the comic book universe to no constructive end? I mean, this is Director Jenkins' show, no doubt about it, in the lighter touch she brings to her characters, and in the way it honors Marston's outlook to the power of love to conquer humanity's darker instincts. But Snyder's fingerprints can be detected, particularly in the battle scenes when the action slows down and Princess Diana is captured in statuesque, exquisitely decorative glory. Beautiful stuff that I loved, actually, but we are back in 300 land, definitely. Afterwards, though, I thought about it, and I wonder whether this break with canon wasn't, in the context of mainstream film, a good thing, and maybe not even Snyder's idea at all. There's a certain criticism that follows mainstream genre, mostly action films that boast women as their protagonists, about what the producers feel needs to be done with a female protagonist in order to make the film mainstream. Here again, I'm being painfully vague to avoid spoiling things, but I will say that the animated film Coraline was subjected to the same criticism with the addition of a character that wasn't in Neil Gaiman's original book, and why people feel that character was added. I think it's possible that Jenkins has attempted to address that criticism with this change, not necessarily for the film in hand, but possibly for any future Wonder Woman films. In a way, what happens here is what Chris Nolan did with the destruction of the monorail at the end of Batman Begins, wiping away all the Tim Burton German Expressionist frills to prepare for the more grounded Gotham of The Dark Knight. I will note also that Wonder Woman cheats a bit by leaving this change, which involves a person, not a place, by the way, somewhat ambiguous. And for the sake of what I think they're trying to do, I hope they don't chicken out. I hope they stick with what's implied with this event, both because to do otherwise would undermine a major dramatic moment in the film, and also because moving forward with it would signal a major change to the presumptions of what's needed in films with female protagonists in order for them to be successful. But while we're on the subject of action films from a woman's perspective, I can note one other major shift to the canon that's a little startling to anyone who knows Wonder Woman, but in retrospect makes a whole lot of sense. Everywhere else, Wonder Woman meets Steve Trevor and is recruited to help fight World War II. But Wonder Woman, the movie, shifts the time frame back to World War I. Part of this may be practical commercial stuff. Marvel has pretty much staked a claim to World War II and the period surrounding it with stuff like Captain America, the First Avenger, and Agent Carter. But it's also a clever shift from the standpoint of the character and what she stands for. Wonder Woman's whole point, after all, is about the power of love over hate. She's a warrior who paradoxically uses her strength in a quest to eliminate the institution of warfare. But World War II was arguably the last war that was fully justified, whereas World War I was about as pointless could get. One of the more powerful sequences of the film has Princess Diana touring the trenches in Europe and witnessing for herself the horrors of modern warfare. With this time shift, then, Jenkins makes a better case for her heroine, and possibly sets us up for the complexities that will arise as the aftermath of the so-called Great War leads to the rise of Hitler. Whatever happens eventually, Wonder Woman does right by the character and what she represents. Coming out of DC, where in recent years the moral ambiguity button has been punched to such an extent that it's become a righteous drag, bringing back the optimism inherent in the DC superheroes, and finally giving full due to the strength, wisdom, and nobility of DC's premier female star, Wonder Woman is a healthy return to what we look for in a superhero film, and is most welcome. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. We're about to get in touch with Terrence Taylor via Skype, because he lives about 20 blocks from here, so we have to use Skype. He's working, you see. So this lets him work till the last moment. And I'm finally, why am I getting a Skype thing on my phone? I see. This is him. That's weird. Okay, I won't get into it, but just a couple of notes for Dan. And actually, I can connect to Terrence at the same time. Is this working? Should be. Okay. It looks like we're connected. Oh, Max, if you're listening, could you come back? This isn't playing for some reason. And I have everything potted up the way it's supposed to be. This is the second time something like this has happened, and there was little we could do the first time. Terrence, can you try contacting me? Wait, no, that's mute your mic. Okay. I'm guessing that Terrence can hear me, but we are simply not hearing him. And this kind of thing happened once before, and then we went Adjust microphone settings. Okay, I mean, this seems to be okay. Maybe, but maybe I should be using... No, it's the speaker, I bet. It's what it's coming in on.
Hear me now?
Oh, there now I can hear you.
Ah, okay, good, good. I was just double-checking.
Maybe okay, you Max, you can go back home. You can continue to go home. He just left here. The problem was, and I'm saying this to note for myself, is that the way Skype was set up here, the default was, there are two sound cards in the particular computer that we're Skyping with, and the speaker was set to the wrong sound card.
Ah.
Okay, so let me finish talking to Dan Persons. About his Wonder Woman review, or I should really say commentary. He does review it. He says he liked it a lot, but he didn't get into his usual, you know, the camera angles were this and that. But he was talking mostly about the move. Okay, two things. He said that Wonder Woman is about love versus hate, and I disagree. It's about a good... it's about war versus peace, really, because, and this is not a spoiler, as anybody who's ever watched Xena, which is really Wonder Woman without the DC comics.
But with the leather bustier.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Although there's a little less boost in the costume for Gal Gadot. Nonetheless alluring. But she doesn't have the same build as Lucy Lawless. But the also, by the way, I'm very pleased in the difference between her and Linda Carter in that she doesn't have to wear the red, white, and blue anymore. She's wearing more of a Greek uniform, which makes more sense. She's an Amazon. She's from Greece. And who does she fight? Same people that Xena and... Hercules fight Ares, and Ares is the god of war. So, there. And the thing about the world, World War I is, yeah, to us it seems meaningless, but since the U.S. entered World War I, almost exactly 100 years and 1 week ago, to be precise, about the last year, I've actually been studying and reading things like The Guns of August and World War I. And World War I was waiting to happen. It may have been meaningless in so many ways, but it was taken out of the context of as a continuation of wars that were going on from the mid-19th century with only this time now with all victorious children and grandchildren, it actually did make a lot of sense. It was just waiting to happen, and there just needed to be a spark to send it off. And it wasn't only that a very, very bad terrorist from Serbia killed Franz Ferdinand. Something else would have set it off. It was going to happen. But that's a whole other historic thing that we don't have to go into. But I do very much like the World War I setting for Wonder Woman. And it underlines the fact that, of course, she is an immortal, or at least not mortal. Unlike Xena. Okay, that was all I wanted to mention. And my review of it was very simple. Was that if you divide the movie into three acts. Terrence, is that common to divide most films into three acts?
Yeah. Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Ask Robert McKee. Yes, yes. I mean, it can be varied, but essentially, generally, yes. It's always three acts.
Yeah. So acts one and two are really great. They're both fish out of water. First, Steve is the fish out of water. And by the way, Chris Pine is great as Steve. And then Diana is out of water in London. And then Act 3, which starts off well enough in the trenches of World War I, but finally it gets down to being nothing more than another boss battle. the same that you find in any superhero movie. It's just like Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Yeah, but it's the inherent, I'm trying to think of the right word, weakness, flaw of the genre. Yeah,
flaw is a good one.
And that structure. There's also a school of thought that says six acts, not three, but it's really, they combine into the same three movements. Anyway, the problem is, because I noticed this for the first time in a really conscious way with The Matrix. The Matrix, the first one, I dismissed the second. The first one.
There were two more?
Brilliant first act. I won't sully your mind with such gossip.
I draw the line as when he sees the Oracle. After that, it goes downhill.
Well, the thing is, the first two acts of the original Matrix are a brilliant intellectual conceit, executed well, building up to a climax. Unfortunately, the problem with the genre is that the climax is 20 minutes of shooting and blowing things up.
Yes.
And that's the nature of the genre. That's what is required of the last act. I just watched John Wick 2 recently, and it just, you know, they had to exceed John Wick 1, which took a lot of doing. So they basically just pick up where it left off and then proceed to destroy more things and kill more people in more varied ways. At some point, someone mentions how he once killed a guy in a bar with a pencil, thus, of course, inevitably leading to the guy being killed by John Wick with a pencil. So we get to see exactly how he managed that. But it is the problem with these things, and I don't know how it can be overcome. I was watching Mission to Mars. It was on TV the other day, and I watched like the last 5 minutes because I guess I was going to watch what came on next. But it's semi-counter to that, in that there is a ticking clock and that there's a storm that they have to take off before everything goes. But the last movement is the contemplative intellectual one of 2001, where they meet the aliens and they is us, and I get to go back to mom and dad and embrace them and get the full knowledge of all humankind given to me by the species that spawned humankind. And that's the alternative to everything blows up and we get 20 minutes of shouting and killing. Guardians of the Galaxy, absolutely, same thing. Good movies, both of them, but both of them, same ending.
Doctor Strange didn't totally fall into that.
Oh my, seriously? The universe ripping open, fights in the mirror world? I just watched the last 5 minutes of that the other
day. Yeah, but you know what?
It's massively just let's like fight and blow up with a lot of effects. Let's walk through Escher-esque 3D landscapes and let's then shred the reality.
Okay, let me compare that to what it's taking from. It's largely taking from, what was that Christopher Nolan film? Intervention? No,
Inception.
Inception, thank you. In Inception, the third act is like out of a lesser James Bond film. Skiing and all that. But in Doctor Strange, the plot is furthered during the big blow up.
Okay, Jim, I'd like to just point out that that's the difference between a good and bad musical. I mean, it's the exact same.
Yeah.
It's just that one uses it well. A bad musical, everything stops for the song and then it picks up again on the other side. A good musical, it furthers the plot. I agree that the action sequences further the plot. The thing is that they do an Inception as well. The problem with Inception goes back to what we were just talking about, where the third act has to blow up. And it's the crisis that I had with the third novel of the Vampire Trilogy.
Testament. You have to plug your books, Terrence.
Yes, The Vampire Testaments is now being read. I'll be reading from that shortly, but that was the big crisis. It's like, I can't just write a book of just everything blowing up. There's a lot blowing up. But it got put into a context, like Doctor Strange, as you say, where all the things that are happening are pushing us forward into the plot. But more through the story. At any rate, going back...
But what about Arrival?
Well, I just want to finish on Inception.
Yeah.
The thing with Inception was, again, the same crisis that I have with The Matrix. Really good first two acts. A little bit of a dubious, you know, sentiment. It was weird that DiCaprio did that and Shutter Island in the same year, since they were virtually the same arc for the character of lost wife, but scandalous history, some terrible thing happening that he's haunted by. He just deals with it in slightly different ways. But the thing is, the point where I lost it with Inception was at the point where they're going into the dream, within the dream, within the dream. And each of the dreams that they're going into is a bad action movie. And each of the dreams, it's like what they have to do to get is shoot more people, blow up more things, or run faster, or ski, and all that stuff. And it was like, oh my God, and I don't want to hear any more about the time differential. I don't care that this is taking 30 years in the other world. Oh, just get me out of this movie was where I got to by that point.
Yeah.
Because when they did a clever, intelligent setup, the payoff became just, we can fit 5 action movies into this half hour and not just one. Oh my God, what joy for the boys.
I'm totally with you on that. I'm totally with you.
Yeah, and not so much for the audience. Doctor Strange, yes. I mean, they kept it down to one basic, you know, this is one guy fighting him, and it came to resolution. I had issues with the Mordo coda at the end, that it's like, right, whatever.
Yeah, but, which is, of course, for the comic. I don't follow many comics, but Doctor Strange was one of them, only because WBAI had a Doctor Strange serial in the early 70s. I wish I had a copy. But at any rate, so I actually have a lot of Doctor Strange comics from the era.
I may have my 70s boxes. I don't know. I've got 4 boxes of 70s comics, evidently, including 2 of Dracula number 10, where Blade is introduced, which has evidently been sold on eBay for $300. So I've decided I've got a
one of my Doctor Strange is sold on eBay for $360.
Yeah, I got to sort through.
And you know, my first edition of Lord of the Rings sold on eBay for $180, but one lousy comic book went for $360 for double. Yeah. That's just wrong. That's just wrong.
I'm sorry. Are you expecting values to exist in this society and culture we currently live in?
Yeah. But anyhow, but Arrival somehow manages.
Now we may move on to Arrival. Yes.
Arrival somehow manages to have a very exciting climax at the end, where the explosion, there's only one explosion and one character killed in the entire movie. And that happens, I would say, sort of marks the beginning of the third act.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is all circumstance, talking, and perhaps a certain amount of there is brinkmanship of destruction, but it's none of that. Let's just, you know, literally cut to the chase.
Yeah, but it's a different genre. It's a different kind of sci-fi movie than The Matrix.
It's
Inception.
It's a real one.
It's because those are action sci-fi, whereas Arrival is actually, yes, exactly, real sci-fi. And real sci-fi is Flowers for Algernon with Cliff Robertson. You know, real sci-fi is 2001, where, you know, and what you have, but here's the thing I would argue.
Metropolis,
Yes. But here's the thing that I would argue.
Forbidden Planet.
Metropolis really ends with a lot of blowing up and running around and screaming. So it's kind of in the first category. But with the secondary category, the citing simply 2001, Flowers for Algernon, and Arrival, what we have is the exact same structure, except that the explosion is emotional and it's or social.
And
Happens in the third act of Arrival? There's a confront. We find out the break between her and her husband. We find out the revelation that she had the daughter. Spoiler alert, sorry, for anyone who may not.
There is no time, Terrence.
Right, but
that is the spoiler.
Right, but
said it.
Well, but even that, and that's a very Zen concept or Buddhist, whatever you want to say. I mean, you can say there's no time at all, but we make it linear because that's how we choose.
It's so interesting. Who even liked the film? It's very interesting how many people missed that.
Where he's unstuck in time. You know, what was that? I don't know.
Slaughterhouse-Five.
Yes, exactly.
Given that Margot Adler had 2 shows on BAI, one of them was Hour of the Wolf, and the other one was called Unstuck in Time.
Well, it's an interesting concept. I'm not fond of the notion myself, to go from like, you know, 80 to like 3 for a moment about it. I like living my life in order. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And here we would be giving away too many spoilers about Arrival, but she does actually live her life in order. The difference is
for our benefit, but there are interjections of it out of order.
Well, not exactly. Not exactly. I have a different interpretation of it.
I was going to say, if you're going to get into semantics with me,
I will simply refer people.
It said one thing to me, another to you.
I will simply refer people to a wonderful science book about that involves a great deal of science fiction, but it's called Time Travel: A History by James Gleick. And came out about a year ago, and it's too bad that it didn't cover Arrival, although it does cover A Story of Your Life, which is the short story on which Arrival is based. And the short story is very dense and all that.
I've heard I want to read it. I have to dig it up because the structure and nature of the story itself was intriguing in terms of how he approached it. My conviction is that there is not going to be time travel in my lifetime, or I would have come back to tell myself that there was.
Yes.
By now. So I know that there is no time travel in my lifetime. I would have found someone who had one, and I would have come back to tell me that it happened.
Well, that is a premise of a lot of the better time travel stories and books, is that this is how they know. And in essence, that is what happens in Arrival.
Wait, what is that mysterious light in the corner of the room?
Ah.
Hang on, Jim. I seem to see myself looking 20 years older, stepping through I can only describe it as a chronological rift.
Now, can you name the story? I can. It's by his bootstraps.
Or The Man Who Folded Himself, which was always my favorite, because he got to have a lot of sex.
Which is the...
No one was with himself, so...
You know what I call that one?
Man Who Folded Himself.
Yes.
Well,
can you believe that... You know, I did an interview with David Gerald about 3 months ago at Heliosphere, where he was guest of honor. And I made that crack about The Man Who Fondled Himself. And he'd actually never heard that one before.
I'm quite amazed.
I find that...
Did he find it amusing?
I find it difficult to believe.
Did he find it amusing, or did he leave in a huff?
He more or less behaved like he was putting up with me.
The world puts up with you, Jim.
You know, he was a little bit put off by the fact that I didn't do an introduction covering everything who he is and that he knew was for radio. And I said, David, aside from the fact that there have already been three panels that covered your life story since he was the guest of honor, when I play this on the radio, which I did, I will have spent 10 minutes before I start this actual speech telling your life story.
You.
Yes.
And he was like, but I wanted to hear about me.
Well, no comment.
I have a story, but I can't tell it.
Yeah, same here.
Oh, although I do have a good story. Which is actually a nice David Gerald story, which I don't think I've...
This is the first time I... Go ahead.
We've never talked about it before. Well, when I was, I would imagine in high school, because I was still living at home in Queens, maybe college. When The Man Who Folded Himself came out, I have my copy somewhere here in the loft. I bought it, read it, loved it. I mean, I was this, you know, burgeoning little gay teenager. I'd found Another Country in Giovanni's Room, and The Man Who Folded Himself were pretty much all that I had as erotic stimulation for like years. And I wrote him a letter. I'm not a big fan of letter writer. I wrote a letter to the Batman show when I was a kid, offering up some story ideas, and got a nice autographed picture of Batman and Robin back, which was like stamped on it or something. I should have kept that. Probably
good worse God. On eBay. An Adam West one?
Yes, Adam West. And I wish
it just increased in value.
Sadly, but it's gone, long gone. I can't believe I didn't keep that. But I have not sent a lot, but I did send one to David Gerald. And Lord, what did I do? How did I get this? He had a caricature of himself on the back of the book, I think. But there's a caricature of David Gerald somewhere. And so on the envelope of the letter that I wrote him, I drew a copy of it with him like reading my letter. And like a little balloon going, you know, read my letter or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or an attention getter or something along those lines. And I got back not one, but two letters from him because he must have put it aside and then not realize he'd already answered it. And then I answered it again. But he wrote me, so I have two letters somewhere in my closet from David Gerald, you know, saying, oh, you'd have to put an attention getter. I answer all my mail and thank you for your kind words. And, you know, just very nice letters back from him. So I felt like, wow, these people are real and exist. You can actually see them. Did I ever tell you about how my friends and I went to the National Lampoon in high school because we loved the magazine? We had taken over the high school magazine and renamed it the Vulture from Venture Magazine, which Archbishop Molloy wasn't thrilled with.
Which is funny because, of course, now Vulture is a very popular magazine.
Oh, I had no idea. That's very funny.
It's like the online entertainment presence of New York Magazine.
I'll have to go look. Well, we were prescient.
And it has some major science fiction writers writing for it.
Well, it reminds me that a friend of mine, I found some friends of mine from high school on Facebook, and one of them, Randy Ivins, had some copies of the school magazine and promised to scan them for me. I think it was Randy. I've got to track him down, or George. It might have been George DeHaven. At any rate, I still have my full National Lampoon collection, which is the first 3 years, I think, except for the first or second issue. There's one missing, but I got to pull them out. I could probably sell those on eBay. And they're in the plastic binders that they sold to put them into, which were horrible because they just completely mess up the magazine. The metal came out and the paper and the – oh, my God. But anyway, they're all bound in there. But we loved this magazine the first year. We modeled our lives on that and Clockwork Orange. We went down to the city to go see them. Because it never occurred to us you can't just go see your favorite magazine. So we show up, and I can't remember. It was in Manhattan.
Actually, of all places, Nat Lamp was pretty easy to get into. It also helped that there was a WBAI staff member working there.
Well, the thing is, we went down, you know.
Are you listening, Frank, by the way? I'm just...
We walked in, and yeah, they let us in. we told them who we were, why we were there, and they were like, okay, yeah, cool. The guys were down the hall, basically. So we met Tony Hendra. I think we met Michael O'Donohue, too. I mean, Tony Hendra was great. He chatted with us for a while. But it was, like, insane that that would happen. You'd never have that happen now.
Yeah, I met Matty Simmons, who was the owner of all things Nat Lamp and the movies and, and of course, let us not forget the National Lampoon Radio Hour.
I have the album.
I have the radio shows.
Which is great for, you know, pull the triggers niggers, if nothing else. The faux Joni Baez song, mm-hmm. which was, and they spell it pull the tree grows negroes on the liner notes.
Yes.
They sing it triggers niggers. But it's great. It is like an incitement to riot. It's a wonderful song. I love that album, Radio Dinner. But yes, they did that. They were great. So I'm flipping channels a few months ago and I hit this documentary, I can't remember the name of it right now, about the National Lampoon. And I sat there watching it with my jaw hanging open. We were lucky we got out of that office alive.
I really did not care for that documentary. I thought it was a hagiography, not counting, you know, until they start talking about all the people who start dying of coke and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But a lot of those people, Richard Belzer did a radio show here at WBAI that I was technically the producer of, because Frank Heller, who's the person I was talking about, who I see is not logged into Skype at the moment, Frank brought him in, and Belzer, who's of course still a big name today, was very much a part of the Nat Lamp post-Lemmings group of people.
Ah, Lemmings, my God.
Well, that's where it all begins. It all begins with Lemmings.
I know. I saw Lemmings at the Village Gate. That's why I bought the radio.
And Lemmings was done in the WBAI Studio C. When they weren't at the Village Gate, they did benefit performances at WBAI when we had a church on 62nd and 1st.
They were on, I'm sorry, but Lemmings was running as a show in the Village for some time.
Yes.
Okay, so you
don't be sorry. I'm telling you that as they were doing that, as they were working for Art DeLugoff at not the Village Gate, but the top of the gate.
Top of the gate. That's what it was.
Okay, I know my history here.
Hey. What I was doing in those days, I'm lucky I remember it at all.
Yes, well, as we would say on the Family Electric Theater, I like the colors, man. I really, I really like the colors.
John Belushi spat on me doing his...
Yeah, John Belushi spat on... He's one of those actors.
He sprayed a lot. Sprayed a lot.
Yeah, he really...
Every part of his body just sprayed everything.
We had Belushi. We had Dan Aykroyd. We had Gilda Radner. We had... a number of those folk. There were and they did a week's worth of benefit performances for WBAI in our studio. BAI, for those who don't remember, those who don't know the history, in the 70s was located in a church, a deconsecrated church on 62nd Street between 1st and 2nd.
I once answered phones there.
And did you? Benefit
one weekend.
Downstairs.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a friend at work who oh God, this memory's Ira? I can't remember his last name.
Weitzman?
No, I don't think so. A kid named Ira worked with me at ANS. He told me he was going to go in. He said, Ira was wild. He was crazy. Had glasses. So I join him. We drive into the city. We go do the whole, you know, answering phones and things at BAI.
Ira was a major. Ira I'm thinking of, Ira Weitzman, who was at BAI and involved in a number of things. He runs.
This would not be the same.
No. The guy I knew at BAI nowadays runs something called Lincoln Center Theater.
But I have no idea what my Ira is doing these days, but it was very amusing because we were in his car. He was parking in the Bowery area. Was the church in the Bowery area?
No. 62nd Street and 1st Avenue.
Ha. Maybe it was another evening I was with Ira. But
now, we had the free music store at Washington Square Methodist Church on West 4th Street.
Nah, I think I just had a couple of evenings out with Ira. I just remember one evening, it was the era when guys would jump at your car and wash your windshield with dirty rags.
The squeegee era.
Exactly, the squeegee era. And someone leapt at his car and he just reached into the glove compartment, pulled a knife out, and just started brandishing it at the window and said, I'll cut you. This is like a white kid from Queens. I think he was Jewish too, a good Jewish boy from Queens. And he's screaming, I'll cut you. Get away from my windshield. I'll cut you. And then throws the knife back in the glove compartment. We take off. It was too funny. The 80s. I miss the 80s.
At any rate, in that era, Richard Belzer, who did for Nat Lamp Radio Hour, he did the Dick Ballantyne show.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
It's on the records. It's on several of the records, at least two of them. Well, okay, I'm not going to get into the whole story. Suffice it to say that, in essence, I fired him. Then he went on to do, and then his big breakthrough was he was on the TV series Homicide.
Yeah, I forgot that pre-Law and Order. Because it was so funny when he drew up in Law and Order, because he was the same character. They rolled his character over to the other show, didn't they? It seems to me it
not
was
into
the
ordinary
same.
Law and Order, no.
He was on Law & Order for years playing a police detective. But the memory I have
Belzer?
Is that it was the – yes, Richard Belzer, Law & Order. Are you serious? You don't remember that?
No. Then again, I gave up on Law & Order oh, sometime after Michael Moriarty left, you know.
I hated Michael Moriarty on that show. He was, I just so preferred.
I was there for Jerry Orbach. For me. Jerry Orbach was, you know, the height of that show for me.
Yes, no, he was. But Belzer was a secondary character. And when Orbach left, I think he got more primary. But he was on that for decades. But he had come on to Law & Order from Homicide in a like a crossover episode or something.
Uh-huh.
And
I'm remembering that now.
The funny thing about it was that it was the cop from Homicide who came to Law & Order. He was just another New York precinct.
That's so, right.
Yes. I'm pretty sure that's right, because I'd forgotten Homicide completely.
I remember that there was a crossover episode.
Yes, and it was.
He was in special. He wasn't in Law & Order. He was in Special Victims Unit.
No.
Law and Order Special Victims.
Oh, yeah. But that's what he went over to. Yes.
Okay, but you see,
by Law and Order or Special Victims.
Okay, yes, okay, there's like five different shows called Law and Order.
I know. You have to add the suffix.
I think, by the way, between that and CSI, there should be a Law and Order channel.
There is. I mean, there is a channel that pretty much for 12, I mean, I
like 12 hours a day runs Law & Order, I know.
Yeah, and the other half is like Will and Grace, you know.
Yeah, okay, yes.
So here is the interesting thing that I discovered about Law & Order, and it applies to all of their shows. When my mother has insisted living near me, I was spending at least 2 or 3 days a week, you know, up there with her. She's a very comfortable place. They're now turning into luxury condos, bastards. Beautiful little place for seniors, park right there, library across the street, farmer's market every Saturday out front. But when I would go over to visit her, she'd be watching TV a lot, and she was always into like crime shows and stuff, but she'd watch a lot of Law & Order. And at the point she was in assisted living, she was getting, her short-term memory was going. That's why we had to move her near me, because she couldn't be on her own. And that window got smaller. And it hit a point where it was about 15 minutes to half an hour, where if you came in, you started talking, 15 minutes later, she has no idea what you were talking about 20 minutes ago. The thing I realized about Law & Order is every single scene, every time they change to someplace else, someone walks in and they explain what they're doing there and what's happening. And then they proceed to ask them questions. But every 5 minutes in Law & Order, you're being reminded what you're watching, why you're going, and what's going on. And I said, oh, my God, this is like the Assisted Living Channel. This is like the Alzheimer's Channel. This is brilliant programming for people with short-term memory spans. And that's why senior old people love it. They run this thing 24 hours a day. It's the perfect format for people with short-term memory.
Do you know, my God, I'm looking Belzer up in IMDb on my phone, right?
And because that's the world we live in.
And okay, so he played, and he was also on Plain Old Law and Order, but in every get this, he starts on Homicide: Life on the Street in 122 episodes, playing John Munch. Then he was in a series, a series, only one episode, called The Beat, playing John Munch.
I forgot The Beat.
Then he was in 4 episodes, those are the crossover episodes, of Law & Order, playing
John Munch.
Then he was on Third Rock of the from the Sun, playing
John Munch on Third Rock? I've got to go on Netflix.
Then in Law, then in Arrested Development. Not John Munch. No, it's Detective Munch on Arrested Development. Then on The Wire.
Oh, my God. Are you shitting me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You started this. It just prompted me. Okay, but you have to understand something. This is.
I hope I hit the delay button correctly.
I can't even imagine you did, and I'm terribly sorry.
Then 30 Rock. And get this. The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
No, of course, because now everyone has to do it. Okay, but you have to understand what he's done. Richard Belzer is a comedian, right?
Yeah.
We mostly knew him from his stand-up, and then he rolls into this part. He has now successfully carried off a, what, 30-year conceptual art piece where he's portrayed a singular character across about 20 different shows.
I have to say that's brilliant. That's
with probably a consistent history throughout, because I'll bet there are references to the ex-wife and all the things that they would say about Monk's character are consistent throughout. But it's like, oh my God, Belzer is the most brilliant comedian on the planet.
And I made it all possible by throwing him out of WBAI.
You did. So had it not been for you, we would not have the chronology. You could probably have a Munch channel where you just run every episode of TV.
He would go for that.
That would just be weeks of that.
He would go for that big time. By the way, I had good reason for throwing him off the air, and I would do it again today.
Because he said the word I just said accidentally?
No. I'll tell you exactly what it was. Is he was playing, he was in character as Dick Ballantyne, who was a, before, oh, what's the name of the horrible right-wing, pill-popping Hillary Clinton hater.
Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, before Rush Limbaugh, Belzer created Dick Ballantyne, who was a radio host like that. And he was filling in on a time slot which Frank Heller started and then was turned over to Belzer. And Belzer came in with an entourage of people. And what he did was he was in character all the time, never mentioned that his name was, it was always Dick Ballantyne. Okay, fine. He's created a character and he's doing that. But then when it came time to listener calls, he didn't allow the WBAI listeners to call. It was all his people who were distributed around the building, and I was engineering the show, aside from technically being the producer of it. And, you know, I can go along with the radio hoax with the best of them. But there's one thing about the hoaxes that have been perpetrated on WBAI through the years, and that is that at the end of the show, you reveal the hoax. You start out, it should sound absolutely straight, if a little incredible, and then go a little wild and a little wilder until you're finally in some other planet and all that. And then at the end, you say, okay, this is really actor Alan Abel, for example.
Oh, I take exception to that. I would disagree. Okay, here's one. I don't see any difference. First of all,
It's not about him. About the listenership.
No, I disagree, though. But listen to me. I don't see any difference between what you're describing and Joe Frank for the last 40 years, who I think is brilliant and whose work I love and is largely made up of ad-lib conversations on phone lines between him and his friends, which reality and unreality blend to the point you cannot tell which is which. I have no idea what Joe Frank's life is really like. When he got sick, I was convinced it was one of his bits. It was, which must have been the hardest thing for him to actually convince people he was having health crises. But if it was Richard Belzer by name doing what you're describing, yes, you need to say at the end, and we're just kidding. But when it's Dick Ballantyne and people know Richard Belzer is playing a character named Dick Ballantyne, and what he's doing is a radio show with other actors who are playing the people calling in so he can shape the narrative of the show, that's totally what Joe Frank does.
Okay, let me tell you how they are different. Okay, number one, and of course Joe Frank is another person who came out of BAI and did here.
Absolutely.
Joe Frank.
That's my example.
Joe Frank is Joe Frank. Okay, he lives in creates his fantasy world, but that's his name, and the persona is pretty much his persona.
Well. Yes, but it's...
Okay, wait.
Okay, go on.
The list, it's where I draw the line is the idea that listener calls were supposed to be WBAI listeners. Now, you have to remember in those days when BAI late night programming was all, today it's like, you know, Bob Fass and that's it. And me just very occasionally, but we were all free-form radio and very, very dependent on our listener phone calls. Even everybody knew who our cranks were. They had names, from the enema lady to various, don't ask, to various people. Wait. The thing is that they were the WBAI listeners, and it was very important to be truthful at the end. And when you did this week after week, and you didn't, there were people who were very, very upset by saying, "Really, is this your audience?" And it wasn't. And they weren't doing, and Dick Ballantyne was doing things that no BAI host would ever dare do. Never did the name Richard Belzer come up.
Well, see, but then it's the station's duty to do proper framing. What your job should have been then, to say we need to put a bookend on this.
Yes, I did.
That says what this is.
I was, as the producer, I did that, Terrence. We had conversations about it. I was basically flipped the bird. You don't flip the bird to your producer on numerous occasions with verbiage to go along with that and expect not to be replaced. And I replaced him.
Oh, it was Richard Belzer at his peak at a-holeness. You know,
Yes.
Of course you had to do this.
And if anybody ever analyzed the straws that were lying around the station, we'd have all been busted.
Hey, I'm not getting into that subject. I make no illusions, allegedly.
Things go better with Pepsi.
Allegedly.
But I'm saying that this was going on live on the air.
I'm saying...
In those days, this is before the FCC deregulated stuff like this. It was regulated. You're not allowed to take a phone call on the air and not say you're on the air. There are many rules and regulations one must follow, and one of them involves a certain amount of disclosure. And yes, we had discussions about this for, this went on for 3 months before I pulled the plug. And we had these conversations for more than 2 months before.
But, I mean, what kept you from running a tape loop before the show began, before he went on air?
He did.
Explaining that this
he
was
did.
What this was.
He did.
What?
He got absolutely furious when I intro'd the show.
Then why was it on more than a day? Well, whatever.
Because maybe I was too kind.
What?
Maybe I was too kind.
For 3 months, I'm going to start taking massive advantage of you. My God.
Let's not go. We're spending too much time with this topic.
Yes. Go on to elsewhere.
Okay, we have two agenda items that we want to do.
Despite his early history, he has done a massively decades-long conceptual art.
Let me say that he is brilliant. That I love the fact, I didn't realize this whole John Munch thing. I think that's genius.
Oh, it absolutely.
And the fact that he's been able to pull that off is just fine.
I really didn't like him at the beginning, but I liked what he aged into. I mean, the current Belzer for the last 20 years I've enjoyed greatly.
I liked what he did in later times. Yeah. When we were involved with him was in his very earliest...
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure he'd be the first to admit it was the Coke days, and he was probably spinning out like a lot of people were at that time. Pepsi days. But like Freddie Prinze and a lot of other people, I'm sure he just was.
And we actually did have a person on the air named Pepsi Charles. But anyway,
on to the subject. On to two
subjects at hand. One is that I wanted to discuss a current thing going on in media. And the other thing is that you were going to read something from your novel in progress.
Indeed, I am.
And how long is that reading?
It is, I think it's about 8 pages. I'm not sure how long that
is. So about 15, 20 minutes.
2, 4, 6, 8, 9 pages. That sounds about right.
Okay. So do you want to read first? And then chat?
Well, sure, because it would break things up, because we chatted, we could read, and then chat again. Otherwise, it's sort of chat, read, goodbye.
Yeah. So
it's a rhythm thing. It's a rhythm.
Exactly. Thing. So now, if you want, we can take a musical break, or we can go right into it.
What would the music be?
Let's see. Let me switch to the
other
computer.
Would it be apropos? Would it set up the mood?
Let's see. Yes. Yes. I have the perfect song.
Okay.
I have to just find it and cue it up. Many of my regular listeners know this song. You probably know it as well.
While you play it.
Yeah, I will tell you that it was recorded in 1921.
I think you may play this before for me.
I play this a lot. It's a favorite. It's a favorite song, and it definitely involves the theme that
I know it well. Yes.
Okay. So you know what the song is. So it runs 3 minutes, and I will turn your pot down, and we will turn the other potentiometer up and listen to Marianne Harris performing I'm a Jazz Vampire. Hard to believe that song is 95 years old. Not the song, the recording. The recording is 95 years old. Marianne Harris, I'm a Jazz Vampire. I love it.
It's a lovely thing.
It really is. It really is. And yeah, it's not so much about being a vampire. It's just the idea of, you know, well, vampires, I guess, you know, we're still fairly vogue, fairly new, right?
Yeah, a vamp was really more seductive.
Well, the vamp, but she says, you know, Cass,
but she was draining the life of men. So there had to be a vampiric aspect in that way as well.
Yeah, well, that's the idea.
The Vampire came out around the teens. So I think it was probably ramping up with all the Eastern mysticism things that were getting popular.
Well, spiritualism was huge. Vampire was written in 1817, but then Bram Stoker is when, the 80s or 90s?
Yeah. So it's
and also and they're starting to do the silent movies.
Yeah.
You have Nosferatu.
All the ripoffs of Stoker's Dracula and film. Yeah, in the silent movie days.
Yes, absolutely.
Carl Dreyer's Vampire.
Yeah. That's a great film.
Very beautiful. They're both very beautiful, but very different.
Those and Nosferatu, I think, are my two favorite vampire films. Although I've never seen Let the Right One In.
It's the original. I haven't really seen much of
the original. I'm only talking about the Swedish. Great. I'm talking about the Swedish one. Yeah.
The original Swedish one was great.
And then there's another really good movie involving vampires that I like called...
You're going to cite the Jarmusch thing, aren't you?
The what?
The Jarmusch thing, aren't you?
No, I'm not. Although that wasn't bad. Okay. No.
It's beautiful, but just turn down the sound. Oh, God. I told a friend of mine that I was getting to watch that movie, and he said, really? It's just going to be 90 minutes of vampires talking about themselves.
I mean, for one thing, Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston, okay? Right there, you've got me.
Look at the opening shot. Twirling 360 pan down from overhead onto them. I mean, it's gorgeous. It's a beautiful movie. I'm not going to discuss this. This is not what we're talking about right now.
Okay, the other movie I was going to mention is by Ingmar Bergman. You don't remember
Power of the Wolf?
Thank you.
I should have known you were going there.
Well, duh.
Shall I set up my reading? I need.
Well, you can do that, but let me first say that this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming out over WBAI.org. And my name is Jim Freund, and with us via Skype is Terrence Taylor. Gesundheit. Yes. So now you can set up.
Well, the novel has been long in the making. As the second one came out in 2010, and I'm just writing the third one now. And it was for a variety of reasons. I did write another novel in between, not horror, not good. It was very long, but it was very therapeutic, and I needed to write it.
That never sold, did it?
What?
Did that ever sell?
Oh, no. Okay. It won't.
Just asking.
I need to. It's 720 pages long. I have to cut it down by half before it's even readable.
Yeah.
The agent was not. But the words used were that the associate had not thought much of it and that she was equally underwhelmed. Those are the two words that were used. Equally underwhelmed. Mm-hmm. These are not words you want to see in email at 5:30 at the end of a long work day at the office coming through your phone. It was not a good day. However, on the other hand, I'm going to be thanking her profusely in my acknowledgments because last year she emailed me saying, so what is past life going to be done? Which is the title of the third novel.
Of the Vampire Testaments. The
first novel was Bite Marks. The second novel was Blood Pressure. The first took place in 1986. The second took place 20 years later in 2006. And the third one takes place 20 years after. It's a three-generational story.
And let me just point out that for people who listened last week when we had Andy Duncan on, we had a recording of him reading his story, Zora and the Zombie. And you and he have a protagonist in common.
Indeed. I suspect Zora's just reaching out and grabbing all the terrain she can get. But she was in the second novel, having an adventure in the Harlem Renaissance era, Harlem, although she was living in the 60s, East 60s, doing her play The Great Day and meeting a gentleman who becomes a vampire and who she reunites with in the current novel. I have two parallel storylines, one of which is in 1941 with Zora reuniting with Turner, her vampire ex-lover in Los Angeles, on the brink of World War II for the United States. It had been raging in Europe and the East for quite some time. And the present day story is set in 2027 with the survivors. I hate to say them like that, but it's given me actually a chance to do something I've wanted to do for years, because past life is largely about the aftermath of great catastrophes that the people who live in these stories suffer. And there was always a part of me after I would see the end of a movie like Nightmare on Elm Street or whatever, that more of the movies, Nightmare on Elm Street, they kill everybody at the end, but more of the movies where somebody survives, or even fairy tales. What comes after Happily Ever After? I was always fascinated with that era, that period of their lives after this amazing event that put them on the map that's now over. What happens after you walk away from that? How do you survive? And what's the aftermath? And this book is really about that. It's two generations of a family who just had their lives horribly shaped and distorted by supernatural influence. And now it's back. They thought it was over, and they're having to deal with it yet again for the last time. But finding the story, finding my way into it, it got triggered. I was so afraid of writing this book. And I had basically sat and literally the day before the email came, had a long conversation at NERSIF in the booth with SOA and a friend of his, where I was talking about I really wanted to write another novel. I felt I'd been off the horse too long. It had been 2 years since the last manuscript. So I'm talking about this one book that I had brought chapters into the writing group.
Well,
that I really
my name is Terrence Taylor. It's been 2 years since my last manuscript. And
Yes. Well, I felt like more like, I don't know, like, I really had to get back to the gym. I keep paying the membership. I should really use the machines, you know. So I basically had talked myself into writing a different book entirely. And it was just running away from the I'll get to it, but I can't do it now. The next day I get the email from Victoria, and it's like, And it's like, okay, I have one friend in particular, been trying to get it, finally got one, but been trying to get an agent for like 2 years for a manuscript she did. It finally got the right one. You know, I know so many writers who are trying to get just on the radar of an agent. I have a wonderful top agent, got me published for the first time with a 2-book deal. And she's like, where's the book? So I sent her one of the stories. I sent her the last story I did for J.J. Adams, The Catch, for the What the Blank anthology. And she loved it. And she was like, I love it. I love your work. Send me a manuscript. So I was like, oh, my God. I that was it. It was like, I have to commit to this. I had like 200 pages. It's not like I hadn't done anything. I'd done a lot, but I couldn't find my way into it. I couldn't figure out what it was. The 3 books in my mind were symphonic. The first movement, bam, overture. Everything hits hard. Grand Guignol, bloody hell. Second book, second movement of a symphony, slower. Leitmotifs rising, new elements come into play. You see it building. Third one's got to be a killer. It's the freaking, you know, last movement. Oh my God, that's what terrified me for a long time. And what I finally realized was, as the second book was not the same genre, even to a certain degree, as the first book, the third book could be different also. And it sort of morphed into the supernatural action adventure, because it's the climax. It's 20 years in the future. It's 2027. The world's been dragged down for 20 years. My mad vampire, who was released at the end of book 2, has been in charge of an organization with international resources and has essentially done his best to tear the world down in a weird Darwinian sort of reduction sauce. And the funny thing is, at the point that I'm writing the book, it's only 10 years to my apocalyptic future, and we're kind of halfway there. I was sort of freaking out because almost everything has happened in the last 10 years. It's like, oh my God, it seems so distant under Obama. But suddenly, it was all building, and here it is. We're halfway to the horror. So I've been working on this, and the basic chapter I'm going to read now is Claire St. Clair. The song was very appropriate, is a young half Japanese, half French vampire, looks like she's about 16. She was made by Tom of Bedlam, My Mad Vampire, who was released at the end of book, in the middle of book two, but is free to do the world harm at the end of book two. And they've been pretty much committing mayhem for the last 100 years. They blew up the Hindenburg. He was Jack the Ripper. They've been doing a lot of bad things. So they got locked up into vaults and then got freed. So I will apologize. There's a little more blood in this than you may want to listen to, Jim, but I really like it. It won't be too bad. There's more depth than blood. There will be blood. There will be blood, though. There's going to be a lot of blood in this book. So I'm finding the blood, but it I'm so happy.
There was much less blood in the second book than there was in the first.
Yes, no, that's why I'm trying to get Bill Prady, my friend Bill Prady, comedy genius. Everyone knows that. He's co-created Big Bang Theory and is just riding that wave because he's just one of the smarter, funnier people I've ever known. And I love talking to Bill because between the two of us, we know every piece of stupid trivia there is in the universe. Anything he doesn't know, I know, and vice versa. He always tells me something bizarre I've never heard before when I run into him. But he loves the first book. He read the first book. He cannot read the second book because he was so terrified. The nicest thing he ever said to me was that when he was reading the first book, he said, there would just be chapters I would finish, and I would just have to put the book down for a few days before I could go on to the next one. And I was like, oh, thank you so much for that. I have all these wonderful, sweet friends. The fact that any of them have gotten to the first book is a miracle to me because they must have looked at
me. Well, I cringed my way through the first book.
I know,
but I actually had no problems with the second book at all.
No, there's a lot of destruction in the second book, but it's not as sadistic.
Yeah.
The first book was trying to go balls out, just take off any breaks. There's still stuff in that book I thought people would make me take out that just astonished me that I could get away with it. But it was trying to go as far as I could go at the time. I suspect I can actually go farther now, and I'm kind of putting the brakes on some of that. But it was an amazing journey. It took 20 years. I tell all the young writers I know, it's never too late. I actually tell the older writers I know who feel like they shouldn't, you know, oh, I always wanted to, but I never did. It's like, it's never too late to start. I started it seriously in my late 40s, and by 50, I had, you know, and I was in an anthology, and I was almost done with the novel. I mean, I may not have retired off of the book, but I definitely accomplished everything artistically with it that I wanted to. And the third book is just such a joyride right now. So I emailed Victoria a few weeks ago saying, thank you so much for making me do this. I'm just in such a happy place right now. I'm 8 chapters away from the climax of the book. I've written all the 1941 storyline. There's a heavy streak of Lovecraft in this because I've revived the source. You finally find out the source of the white worm in Roman's Will in the Sheep Meadow Station in book one. There's a lot of perverse little closure in this where we find out things. At any rate, the chapter I'm going to read is at a point in the book where Tom is fairly far along the way with his great plan to destroy the world in a very specific way, but it's become more literal than people thought it was. They thought he was just running it downhill, and Claire St. Clair, his consort since the 1920s, so that song was quite apt, is realizing that there's something more going on than she thought. Pardon me for a minute. I'm going to clear my throat. You may want to just mute me for a second.
Okay, you are now muted. And 3, 2, 1, you are now unmuted.
And I'm back. So this chapter is sort of, hopefully by the time people read the book, they'll have forgotten this. It's not really a spoiler, though, but it's a fun one because it's sort of Claire going, oh, as her discomfort level rises. And anyone who's read the books and knows Claire St. Clair knows it takes a lot to make her uncomfortable. So so here we go. This is 2027. This is the summer. It is Brooklyn. And we are dropping in to the lovely Claire St. Clair. She wanted to kill him. The ageless vampire Claire St. Clair roared through Brooklyn in her beloved black 55 Jaguar XK coupe convertible top down, a gift from Tom of Bedlam on the anniversary of their first centennial together. That was back in the good old days. Tonight, Tom hadn't answered any of her texts. She knew where Christopher Jude Miller was. Her clever little street scouts had tracked him to a house in Park Slope. But until she talked to Tom, she couldn't be sure if she wanted him. But until she talked to Tom, she couldn't be sure if he wanted him recaptured or not. What if Miller's escape was part of whatever plot Tom was cooking up on the side? She was used to swift, decisive responses. Damn him for leaving her so uncertain. All she knew for sure was that if they wanted Miller back, they had to act fast. He wouldn't be in Brooklyn long. No one smart enough to break out of Clean Slate headquarters would be stupid enough to be caught again easily. They'd incapacitated guards, erased video surveillance, and walked out the front door as if they owned the place. You didn't want a SWAT team to just kick in their door without knowing what was on the other side. Not even Clean Slate's media suppression unit could quell news of an armed battle on the streets of Park Slope. Claire arrived at the block where her Tom was. She slowed her car, looked for parking, saw another car pull into a space and slid up alongside it. Claire motioned for the driver to open his window. He was the kind of vacuously pretty boy broker type she used to eat as an appetizer before she developed the stable. His eyes widened in appreciation as he got a good look at her. But before he could make a stupid remark she was sure they would both regret, she threw out a line from her mind and hooked him. "Pull out," she commanded. "Get lost." His pale blue eyes seemed to drift in and out of focus for a moment as he restarted his car and pulled out of the space, drove away into the night, never to be seen again. Having complete control over mortal minds made parking so much easier and was the only reason Claire owned a car in New York. She stepped out and climbed the stone stairs to the front door. The Montauk Club on 8th Avenue in Brooklyn was founded in 1889, a pillared faux palazzo inspired by one the architect had seen on the Grand Canal of Venice. The Gothic architecture, with magnificently carved mahogany and stained glass windows, was exactly the kind of mansion Tom used to feel at home in. It was a sort of gaudy, overblown display of wealth his stupid family had reveled in before he wiped them out, paid them in blood for what they'd done to him. Now here he was, settling into their old ways as if he'd never left the peerage. Claire seethed as she stormed up the stone steps to the massive wooden door in stiletto-heeled boots over black leather pants and an ankle-length matching coat, nothing else but gold bangle bracelets down each arm and hoop earrings. It wasn't wealth she despised. She'd accumulated enough of it herself in the last century. No, it was the kind of men who accumulated it, who narrowed the focus to that one act to the exclusion of all others, the kind who'd made her their virgin whore in Berlin when she was still human, forced to feign virginal innocence for their entertainment night after night, long after any virtue she possessed had been purged in service to their carnal desires. Her old rage burned brightly as the front door opened. Claire slammed it hard, used its weight to hurl whoever was on the other side back into the lobby. Her .45 automatic came out of her pocket as she slammed the door shut behind her and fired through the doorman's head. It exploded with a satisfying burst. Claire could feel Tom close, a steady hot hum that pulled her upstairs. She strode up the steps before her, fired at the two men in black suits who stepped forward to meet her, hands raised in warning, and easily dodged their falling bodies as they tumbled past her. The door to the bar was open. There was only one more of Tom's drones between her and her objective. He was flung into the room, dead, as she stormed in and saw Tom seated lazily at the curved wooden bar, as if expecting a date, an empty glass in hand. She'd been half convinced this was what all the secrecy was about, some mortal chippy on the side, as if she cared who he toyed with in his spare time. Let him do as he liked, he could still be hers. She'd expected more agitation from him as he saw her, once he knew he'd been found out, but he seemed cool, calm, even amused. "You do make an entrance," he said. "Spare the bartender till I get my refill." Tom held his glass aloft, and the bartender filled it from a silver shaker, so enthralled he didn't even tremble. "It's been a busy night back at the ranch," Claire said as she reached Tom. "I would just love to know what the F was so important here you couldn't answer my texts." Tom gestured, and the bartender put another full glass in front of her. Claire shot him as soon as it was down. Tom raised an eyebrow. on staff here for 40 years before I made him mine, an artist in his own right. You really should respect my property, if not propriety. My favorite drink is his invention. He's the only one who knows how to make it. He peered behind the bar at the body while Claire glared at him with as much hate as she could muster. What the F am I supposed to do? Shouted Claire. About young Christopher? Nothing. We have 20 years of samples and research, and that's taught us only that we can't get what we want from him. I don't care about curing vampires. That's all his blood does. If anything, I knew what Perronel has. All the power of a vampire with none of the problems. So we just let him go after 20 years. He's unimportant and of no threat to us. Tom smiled at her as if she were a child who'd solved a simple picture puzzle. Claire wanted to slap him but knew he wouldn't feel it. She shrieked so loudly, glasses on the wall rattled. She emptied the rest of her gun's clip into the body on the floor, stood shaking by the bar. Tom rolled around on his stool to face her. You need answers. I see that now. I'm sorry. He drained his glass, set it down, and held out his hand, led Claire to the door. They walked to a small service elevator at the back of the building. There are residential apartments upstairs, he said. I've commandeered one for a side project. The door opened into a hallway, and he took her into the nearest apartment. She could hear male voices inside, a low, steady, focused buzz of prayers that grew louder as they walked in and down a wood-paneled hallway to a large open area. Claire imagined it was where the living and dining rooms had been, but the walls had all been knocked out recently, even those of the bedroom and bathroom, to form a large open area that occupied the apartment's full space. She thought that would have caused some problems with holding up the ceiling, but it too had been largely removed, a perfect circle overhead left open to the sky. The floor is occupied by a dozen men in robes, arrayed in a ring underneath the hole around a dozen rough, raw pine wood triangles, more than 6 feet in length, each of which held a shackled human hostage, arms spread and bound with plastic ties across the wide top, legs bound together at the point. The feet were inside the circle, the heads near the robed officiates who knelt beside trays of exotic instruments. They used them to slowly carve symbols into the skin before each of them. Ah, the victims all very much alive. From overhead, it would look like a sun drawn by a child, a body between each ray. The scent of slow-rising fresh blood was intoxicating, the lower notes of that spilled earlier mingling with it in harmony. She kept control, glad she'd fed before coming over, wanting to be sure she was at full strength for whatever she might find. This surpassed all expectations. Claire had seen blood and violence in her day, but this weird ritual was beyond the casual torture she and Tom had indulged in over the decades. The low rumble of voices and constant prayer was a summons. She could feel that even without understanding the words, felt the longing, the invitation. Tom watched her reaction, his smile only mildly wider. Sorcery, she asked. Why didn't you just say so? I suppose I was afraid you'd think me foolish for going back to an old love. You never loved magic, Tom. You loved illusion. Mischief and misdirection, that's all. Her cool hand stroked his cold white cheek and he kissed it. Why did she sometimes feel as if it wasn't Tom she was talking to lately, that he stared at from behind his own eyes, trapped inside his head, begging for her to help him? What are they doing? More devilment, to break down mortal resolve, time to raise the stakes, to stay on schedule. Tom walked around the ring as she followed, slipped a fresh clip into her gun in case she needed it, but kept it in her pocket. She saw that the monks themselves were tortured as well, torsos encased in silver vests woven of fine, complexly twisted barbed wire, dotted with beads of blood, glimpsed through the open front of their robes. Each wore an IV in one arm, fed from a small electric device behind each of them on low stands that kept them nourished and hydrated, catheter tubes siphoning off waste into a central drain to one side in what remained of one of the apartment's bathrooms. No coffee breaks here. Been at it since L.A. died, said Tom. Busy, busy. She had to admire the architectural improvisation it took to recreate a primeval altar to only Tom knew what, in modern Brooklyn, with all the modern conveniences to keep a prayer circle going indefinitely. What keeps the rain out? Claire asked, looked up at the open sky as dark, rumbling storm clouds rolled in from the park. Tom glanced upwards. Nothing. They just don't care. He waved his hands overhead. And no one sees anything from outside either. Neighbors, planes, news copters, protective wards or something. They're remarkably clever about that sort of thing. I still don't. He pressed a finger to her lips, the other to his. The vampire Ramon possessed an invaluable storehouse of ancient occult armaments, some used in the Crusades to drive the Christians back from lands his Muslim empire held, but others withheld, so terrible that to unleash them would bring certain doom to both sides, if not the world. His people had mastered feats of magic so great even they were hesitant to use them. But Ramon couldn't resist a test. Brought one little sample over from another dimension that's just filled with, well, indescribable things. He kept a pet albino worm from there in his lair under Sheep Meadow. Monstrous thing. Miles long, trapped underground. He held periodic sacrifices to keep it from eating Manhattan, but it gave him power. Secrets. I found them all in Clean Slate's files after Richmond told me where to look. Why would you release another one now? Well, because I'm smarter than any of them, aren't I? Murdering Los Angeles wasn't just a way to declare nationwide martial law with our enthralled president in charge. It was a sacrifice, the release of power that my monks have channeled from here since it began. Ramon's worm was generated by the death of mere hundreds of millions who died in Los Angeles, so the key to... He stopped, looked at her slyly like someone who suddenly realized he'd said too much. Don't worry, it's just a minor monster. Nothing earth-shattering. Tom laughed and spun away, out the door. Claire stared after him until she could bring herself to follow him. The mad vampire Tom O'Bedlam. She'd called him that for so long, she'd forgotten it hadn't begun as a joke. It was the name his enemies had given him when they locked him in a steel vault sealed in concrete for eternity for his crimes against the world. A sentence she'd forced Clean Slate to end. The mad vampire Tom O'Bedlam. Had she been right to free her love? Was he still her love? Whatever this was, it was crazy. She followed him out the door and kept her mouth shut. For the moment, there was safety in silence. Later, well, she'd see what she had to do later. And that's the introduction to part two of the book.
Excellent. Most excellent. I was thinking of queuing up Bedlam Boys, Tom O'Bedlam, by Steel Eye Span, or I have a few versions of it, actually. But I didn't want to take up too much time because we have only half an hour left, including my outro music.
And we still have ground to cover, as it were.
Yes, we have. We should at some point move on to the topic we were going to. But, you know, it's a really, really good start. I have great hopes for this book. My problem is that by the time this comes out... Volumes 1 and 2 will be out of print, won't they?
There are copies that are still available on Amazon, some secondhand, which is like very amusing to me.
Have there ever
I think
How about
ebooks?
Are still available. That's what I was
Well, I was going to say I think ebooks are still available freely. My dream, to tell the truth, would be that if they the contract gives Macmillan first refusal on actually anything I do that's paranormal, which sounds really a little strange and creepy, but I wasn't going to object because I was very happy with them the first time, and to have them publish, you know, anything else of mine would be delightful. But my dream would be that they would be so enthusiastic about the book that they would republish all three as one volume in three parts within it, so that it would be the Vampire Testaments coming out and people, because it got so lost when it came out, and in the Vampire Tsunami that year.
This is, which part of Macmillan is this? Tor?
Griffin.
Oh, Griffin. Griffin, yeah. Press. Okay.
Yeah.
But
no, I was very happy with them. I wonder if Monique is still there. She was, Monique Patterson was my editor. She was just amazing.
I know some of the PR people around there. I do not know the editors.
Yeah, black editor. She was actually L.A. Banks, Leslie Banks' editor on the vampire novels that she did. Yes, yes. Which was part of the reason my novel had appealed to her. She saw potential for it. And
there's not a glut of novels, of vampire novels now the way there was.
No.
Although it's going to happen again with the new Stephen Moffat series.
What's that going to be? What's the new Moffat series?
Oh, you don't know?
I've been writing, Jim. I don't get out much.
Yeah, lately. No, this is news of like 3 days ago. Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss are starting a new TV series.
Okay.
You know, they're giving...
It's not going to be... There might be vampires again.
Yeah. It's called Dracula.
Well, but I wish I could be more excited about that.
I mean, exactly.
The
first two episodes will be great.
But they just did Dracula. I mean, they put him in the 20s in the Industrial Revolution or something. I mean, it was like, who just did that? That was there. I mean, it's like, really? I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Dracula. I reviewed Power of Darkness.
Yeah, you and Buffy Summers. But
it's like, really? We haven't gotten beyond that?
How many Sherlock series are there at the same time?
I was going to say, but this is the perfect segue into the topic at hand, which is the burgeoning number of adaptations from print media.
Exactly.
Into TV and films, from comic books to novels, from American Gods to Wonder Woman. More and more mass media is looking to other forms of story.
Well, I want to leave out Wonder Woman. I want to leave out comic book movies. Not necessarily, however, comic book.
No, that can be covered another day.
And even comic book TV series, because, for example, you know, the whole DC Universe, Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, which I loved the first season of and sort of gave up on the second season.
Hmm.
I even watched the musical mashup between those, and I wasn't that impressed, I'm afraid. Hmm.
The musical Flash episode?
Yeah, well, it was a crossover between Flash and Supergirl and Arrow.
Yes, yes, right, because she was with him, yes. I caught that.
Because
the last 20 minutes of it.
You know, they had John Barrowman in there, and the Flash was apparently a refugee from Glee.
Whatever. All I know is that it was like, seriously? I mean, because the premise of it was just, I wasn't pleased.
But we're talking a lot about something
that we're not talking about.
What we are talking about is this relatively new form of ongoing, close-ended, like 8 and 10 and 13-hour movies, which are then turned into one-hour episodes and series, which many of which are taken from literary sources or remakes of other media sources, and a very few of them are original. But I'm interested in the adaptations because all of a sudden they're going where few movies ever go. They are actually mining bona fide quality science fiction and fantasy with things like The Handmaid's Tale and Legion to delve into
comic book.
Yes, but the way it was done to Fargo, which is done by the same guy who did Legion.
Movie stores.
I did mention other media.
Oh, okay.
as being a thing, and it's a movie source, but they've actually, I mean, in a way, the TV version of Fargo is actually almost more literary than the
it's got the room to be.
And even more off the wall than the Coen brothers. which is hard to do. You know, then
not anymore. They open that door, and there's a generation raised, weaned off of them that are like even sicker and more twisted.
Yeah, and
I mean, I still remember how shocked I was when I watched Hostel, and it was like, whoa, is this where we are now? And it was brilliant. It was like political. It was terrifying. It was horrifying. It was awful in a humanistic kind of way. But it was like it showed me where you
go. There were a lot of people. There's a movie I would obviously
it led
never
to the
watch.
Saw movies.
But
you'll never see it.
Yeah, no, I'll never see it. No, but there are people who I respect who really respected Hostel.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant. Hostel 2, girls, couldn't watch that. Good cast. I actually watched the last 10 minutes, brilliant ending, because it totally flipped the whole thing. But just
but again, that's,
90 minutes of girls being brutalized is a lot more than I get.
But things like The Man in the High Castle, the idea of taking these often literary sources and taking the universe and with the exception of American Gods and to an extent The Handmaid's Tale, discarding the novels, discarding the original worlds and setting taking the universe and setting new stories in there.
Well, so what we're really talking about is sourcing and expansion beyond the realm of the original material into its own little parallel universe. I mean, I read a
which are semi-closed endings.
Well, but the novels have semi-closed endings. But what you're talking about is how the series open themselves out to go beyond the parameters of the novel, so the stories can be continued. Preacher, which is a comic book route, the first season to me essentially by the end simply gets them to where the actual comic book began, mm-hmm. which was interesting to me because it was like, well, does that mean the second season is actually going to be the storyline I remember? Because there were a lot of differences. But the thing is, what it does is two things. One, it gives people who read the original source material things, aspects they love of the original, in a new configuration they can watch and still get elements of surprise, which sometimes is good and sometimes is not so good. But it is interesting because I think it sort of – I think Game of Thrones may have triggered that. I cannot think of a series previous to Game of Thrones that had that kind of commercial impact. And commercial impact is what drives Hollywood.
And the fact is that I think you're right.
Because I can't think of a novel before that got me into a TV series.
I think it started
other than Peyton Place, which is decades ago.
Yeah, but I think
that
Game of Thrones
transcended the book and
started
continued.
It. And one of the important points about Game of Thrones and where they're going is that Game of Thrones is going to have not one, two, or three, but four spinoffs.
Oh, dear God, save me. Thank God I never started watching it. I won't feel committed to watching it.
I think we're going to be, if you'll pardon the expression, snowed under.
Sure.
Yeah. Not a bad pun for somebody who doesn't even watch the show.
I was going to say, I'm sure that's really funny to people who know the show. I have no clue why that's funny. But
because Jon Snow is one of the most important characters in it.
Ah, yes, because my obliviousness to the plot is only exceeded by my lack of knowledge of characters.
I haven't seen it. I watched.
Yet you're making a Jon Snow joke.
Yes, because I follow media.
Oh, yes, because
I read the Hollywood Reporter. I you know, I read Facebook. I know what people are talking about.
I've been writing a novel the past year. I'm usually up on this thing.
This is about 7 years old now, but what the hey. But you know, I would probably like that show if it wasn't for the fact that they go not just for the gore, but they do it gratuitously. And that was
I don't know that it is gratuitous if it's brought to the audience. It seems to be just as much as they want to
well,
see.
Well, you've
any
watched.
Any less would disappoint them.
I've only seen two episodes now of American Gods. Now, American Gods is one of my favorite novels, period, bar none. In fact, when Margot Adler was in the middle of her 300 vampire book spree, which included your two books.
Indeed.
And the only break that she took, and this was largely me causing her to do it was to read American Gods, because, of course, this was, you know, right up her alley. And so I have been watching. I'm absolutely fascinated by, really enjoying the television adaptation. As I said, I've only seen two episodes. I'm also catching up on a lot of other shows, including Genius, and which is semi nonfiction. The thing is that the first episode of American Gods, in the first 5 minutes, something that is not in the book at all, are characters that, in the first two episodes, they each show a god from a foreign land coming to America.
Arrives, yes.
Yes, first with the Vikings, and then with the slave ships in the second episode. For the Vikings comes Odin, and or Votan, or whoever you like. And then Anansi comes over on the slave ship. And now, in the first episode, they say the Vikings do this, the Vikings do that, until the Vikings hack each other's limbs off gratuitously.
Trying to summon their god.
Yes,
trying to summon their god.
Yes,
they with war, blood and violence, which is what their god came for.
Their god.
Then
is
they poke
also
out one eye.
The god is the god. Yeah, well, that actually I bought. I did not buy the hacking the limbs off. Votan is not exactly the god of war. He is the god of contracts. He is the god of many things.
He's all father. He is.
He is all father because he is the father of all the gods.
Yeah, but you have to remember how he got there.
Yes, and you know how he got there? There's a very fine book, a wonderful book that explains it all, called Norse Mythology. Guess who wrote it?
Margo.
Neil Gaiman. Yeah.
He's written everything.
It's his latest book. This is not a coincidence.
Gee, I can't imagine why he'd write a book about Odin while he's got a TV series about Odin on the air. You think maybe he might think someone watching that show might buy his book?
Yeah, well, actually, there is a story behind that, and I will have the person who got him to do it, Elisa Quitney, who you've met, on the show soon. She's also going to be doing a Nursef reading. So there. Her father, you may recall, is Robert Sheckley. At any rate, Norse mythology is a wonderful book. It's sort of like, remember the old Edith Hamilton mythology books with the Greek gods and like that, and there are any number of books about African gods.
I was raised on. I was weaned on Bullfinch's mythology and went on from there.
Exactly. Well, Norse
Which
mythology...
Which is why I know Norse mythology. I was talking to Danielle, who wasn't quite getting it because she had to go back and actually find out, and I was like, oh, really? I was sort of surprised. I was like, doesn't everybody get that?
Well, there,
but no,
there
not
is,
everyone has Bullfinch's
Well, there is... Yes. There is this book now. It's only about 4 months old, maybe half a year old, called Norse Mythology by Neil Gaiman, and it's exactly in that class. It tells the origin story of the Allfather, of Thor, and of Loki, basically. Tyr, it touches on several of the stories. It's really an eye-opener. It's really amazing, and the way that Gaiman sourced it, I think that he knew more about Odin after he wrote this than when he wrote American Gods. He really did his research. So, at any rate, the point is, Odin is not the god of war. He's called the Allfather because he is the father of all the gods.
I don't remember the Norse actually having a god of war. I mean, Thor is the closest you can come to it.
Thor is the god of thunder, and he's rather dim. Donner is his other name.
But I'm basically saying that
he's not
there's
a god
no
of war,
god of war in Norse mythology.
That's correct. There is no god of war.
Which to me says that the Allfather can certainly claim the crown. I'm saying that Odin
Odin is the god of contracts, and if you break the contract, he will break you. But that's about it.
But that's what I'm saying. And I don't think he can be limited to just the god of contracts. I'm saying he's the power base. He maintains it with power, is all I'm saying. That we can't think of him as gentle, and the hacking of limbs, the all of that.
He's the god of contracts, and he's also an inveterate liar. He's no more honest.
As he's being played in American Gods. So, getting back to American Gods, I had read that essentially Gaiman was using the first season would cover about a third of the novel. The second season would begin to wander off. There's already talk of an Anansi Boys novel spinoff. But that the show essentially becomes open-ended, that it could indeed continue on the boundaries of the novel's story.
Already within the first two episodes of the TV series, they've already begun to spin off tales. In the book, there are parenthetical stories that don't necessarily add to the plot, but just add up to hear different stories about American Gods. And the TV series is doing that as well and going into areas that the book does not. And then,
yes, though, I think I haven't read the book yet, though they seem to be connecting them better, because there was a lot of, as you get deeper in, you're too in and I'm done. And this gives nothing away. Things that seem random suddenly reconnect later, and which I like, because I was feeling a little disjointed at halfway through. I was feeling like I would like one episode, but I was sort of used to that from Legion, because Legion also did some radical genre shifts from episode to episode. I have to go back and rewatch that now.
Yeah, I'm ready to rewatch that. I thought Legion was genius, and I'm not a fan of it the way you are. I didn't even know it was an X-Men story when I started watching it.
Yeah. Well, but I think both of these, I mean, I don't think you have to be a Gaiman fan or have read the novel to enjoy the TV series. What I find interesting is both the potential and pitfalls of the process, and see how wonderfully alliterative that was. because one of two things is going to happen. You can take this thing and you can run with it and run into the ground, or you can run places. I mean, Legion to me is carrying the concept of the character to places that I can't help but imagine are pleasing Chris Claremont, because they've taken his child and they're raising it well. And they're doing it in a very Claremontesque way, you know, because they grasp the roots of it, of Chris's brain. And that's one of the things that in the last 5 years of reading the Marvel app, I've come to really appreciate. It's like, oh, he's very clever at the readings and things, but my God, what
you
the man
has done.
You
should read his novels, by the way.
No, I have to. I have to. Now, I've been reading all these things I have to review, but I've got a few more things on my list, but I have to go track them down, because I would love actually to read his novels, because I love the way his mind works, and seeing it just unbound in word as opposed to word and picture would be fascinating. But the thing is that they stayed very true to the essence of what he did with the creation of the character. And they've got potential to go a large number of places with it, back into where he took it, out of there into other places. American Gods, what Gaiman's doing is giving him much the same landscape where he can diverge from the original narrative. One of the things already is the Queen of Sheba, which I was reading a piece the other day because I was like, who the hell is this woman? She is amazing. I mean, that actress is just created, and I won't say anything, but you get more of her. And what you see is as remarkable as the introduction.
Well, that's something, by the way, that I loved. Okay, the first time I read American Gods, I read it twice. The first time I did it, I just read the book as a rollicking adventure, which is the way that I'm seeing the TV series. The second time I read it, I also read Gaiman kept a blog at the time he was writing it, and he was talking about discovering these various gods. So I would read a chapter, and then I would say, oh, here's a new god, and I would find out their history, and I would read all about it, and there would be links to Wikipedia, which would link to this, that, and the other thing, and then I would get back, and I've got to tell you, there is so much joy in finding out who these various gods are. And in the TV series, they don't spoon-feed it for you in any way, shape, or form. It's a lot of fun after watching each episode to realize, you know, they don't tell you easily that that woman is the Queen of Sheba.
Well, no, I got that from Googling. I mean, yes. I had no idea. But well,
exactly,
the thing is,
exactly.
I mean, it's been fascinating because it's like Astarte. I remember Astarte. I mean, she comes later. You'll come. You'll get to her.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's like, but yes, but the it's, but see, it's.
The and by the way, in case you don't know, there is a novel called The Anansi Boys. So when they talk about
that, yeah. I've read that. I've read.
And I have to say, I did. It was fun. But I did not care for it anywhere near as much as American Gods.
That's what I'm curious about American Gods. The thing is that, yes, it's subtle. Part of the issue that I was having with American Gods, which I didn't have as much with Legion, partly because they stayed fairly consistency, I think, with David, so he became the through line for me. But at any rate, was the episodic nature of the episodes where you would be in each episode with the arrival of another god and how they got to America and built their base or lost it, other than the new gods. It's all about the immigrant gods. And there's a wonderful animated piece of one of them that's amazing. There are just so many of those openings are all great. But again, it makes it episodic to a certain degree. Part of it was that the gods get introduced. Some of them I recognize right away because I have a good background in mythology. Anansi is still my favorite. Only seen him twice in the first season. So pissed about that. Orlando Jones is brilliant in the role. But everyone is. That's the thing.
Oh, my God. The actors. I didn't even recognize Cloris Leachman.
Oh, her I recognized immediately. The one I didn't recognize was Gillian Anderson in her first appearance.
Right, right.
Because, I mean, I watched that whole scene, and it was like, that's great. I wonder who's doing Lucy. Then she shows up again in another character doing the Ziggy Stardust. And it was like, oh, my God, that's Gillian Anderson. And I hadn't read anything about the show. So I knew I hadn't read any of the buzz. And then it was like, oh, my God. And each time, and I actually don't know what she's doing in episode 8. I have to find that out. But the thing is, all of it, the performances in the show, the design, the direction, I mean, the whole mise-en-scene, as we would say in film school, the elements that make up the whole thing. Dane Cook as the cuckolding best friend. I mean, he's such an a-hole, and he's perfect casting for that.
He really
you
is.
Have not yet gotten to what's the actor's name? Damn it! I can't even believe I can't see it here. The cast in front of me, which I put up so I wouldn't lose it. But Mr. World. Is when you get to Mr. World, Crispin Glover.
Oh, God, yes, yes.
Have
yes,
you gotten
no,
to him
no,
yet?
No, 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 I, yeah, yeah, yeah. I, we have nice. Glimpsed him. We have glimpsed him.
Okay, the thing, the moment when they introduce the character, I don't want to give anything away, but he makes an entrance. Our two heroes are in a room. Everything stops around them, and the new gods come in to pay them a visit. And you get Gillian Anderson doing another amazing performance. It's another character of media. And then they cut to the other side, and you cut to feet walking down the hall. And with each footfall, the floor lights up like the Smooth Criminal video.
Yeah, we have to explain, by the way, that Gillian Anderson plays Lucy Ricardo.
In the first appearance.
Well,
each appearance, yes. She's a different character from media.
Right.
She's the goddess media, and she incarnates in figures that we worship in media. And it's a brilliant concept, but and her performance of it. So she's, shall I say who she is in this scene? You haven't seen this yet. I don't want to give anything away.
Don't.
I won't tell you who she is.
It's actually, I don't mind. I don't care, there's an audience.
No, but I won't say that. I don't want to ruin anything, but this one thing. The entrance of this character, the leader of the new gods, Mr. World. I didn't know the casting before it comes in. You see these feet hitting the floor. You see the floor lighting up. You see someone slide into frame with the head down, with the hat, with the coat over the shoulders, just like Michael Jackson in the Smooth Criminal video. And he raises his head, and it's frickin' Crispin Glover. And I nearly shat myself. It was the most perfect moment in the series up to that moment. And they've
okay,
had many
you just
since.
Made me hit the button again.
I said frickin'.
That wasn't the word. It was the one after that.
What did I say? Well, you can't tell me what I said, but I was trying to be
very
careful.
It was the S word in past tense.
That's a, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
okay,
not the
okay.
usage of the word. It's the intent of the word. It's okay. Scatological usage, and that is not allowed.
So if I was talking about the blank that I have laying around my apartment, meaning clutter, that would be acceptable.
Yes.
I'll remember that for future usage.
Yes. That,
at any
that,
rate,
that
it
is
was
correct.
Wonderful, because Crispin Glover doesn't do a lot, and he is so freaky weird. And when he actually does pop up out of his Ratman notebook world, you know, I mean, the remake of Willard was just excessive. But he's perfect in this. Everyone is perfect in this. Each little beat of this, I have to give them credit. It took me a while to remember that I knew Emily Browning from this weird movie where she plays this daughter in this psychodrama movie where she's got her sister and they're both accusing her stepmother of having murdered their mother. And by the end, you realize stepsister's long dead. She burned down the house that killed mom and this and her sister. And she's like, been locked up for a long time. She should stay locked up and goes back to the asylum. But she did such an amazing job in that movie because the first half is sympathetic, victimized girl as you build to realizing what she
Terrence,
really is.
Do you hear
I just
any,
looked at the clock.
Do you hear any music?
I do. I just looked at the clock.
Yeah.
So we'll continue on this theme on another
Yeah, week. I would really like to pick this up again, maybe even next week. Who knows?
You never.
Because what I'd also like to talk about is the adaptability of the form. Not yes. so much what we're getting hung up on American Gods and this one and that one, but there is a sea change in media that is going on that is being enabled by cable and by streaming form.
And the digital format that makes a lot of things possible that weren't.
Exactly. And I would like to talk to you about the media form itself and not just these individual yes. examples.
Indeed.
So, your website, Terrence.
TerrenceTaylor.com or DoYouBelieveInVampires.com. Very easy to find if you can't spell Terrence with one R. And I also have a quarterly review column in Nightmare Magazine now called Read This, where I recommend at least two good books each column.
Okay.
So the new one's coming up soon.
Very good. So thank you. Thank everybody for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. He was Terrence Taylor. He still is. And
will be.
And I will be back next week. Possibly he will be as well. And we'll see where we'll take this conversation because I'm fascinated by it. And everybody be good to each other because we deserve it and you deserve it. And a lot of good stuff coming out. So do all check it out. Okay, thanks again, Terrence.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, I haven't told you. There's a Nyrsa reading July 6th.
Remind me before.
I will. I don't even know who it's going to be yet. just telling. July 6th and August 1st. August 1st is Carlos Hernandez and Ms. Cooney, Claire Cooney. Uh-huh. That'll be a good one. Okay. Cool. So, thanks again, Terrence.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you all for listening. And, oops, what did I do wrong this time? Oh, I know what I did wrong. There we are. Okay. Listener is here with Burn Baby Burn Clapper. If I, yes, he has access to the machine. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to, like, go back a little and, you know, give him a little more of my outro music so that he can do a proper segue. So, again, thank you. Meet us on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group or write me jim@ourwolf.com, HOUWOLF.com. Take care and good morning. The sun.
When I leave, you're going to know my status with the last words on my lips. And I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech and the thought of like a match to the American flag and burn.
99.5 list alive. In tune to WBAI 99.5 FM New York. And exactly, let's see, 6 minutes after the hour right here at 99.5 WBAI. Let's take it from the top. Yes, I am. Pablo Moses. Too Black, Too Strong. From the album called Burn Baby Burn on Clapper's Records. That was Brown and Black Radio in Imperialist USA. You know it go, right? Yeah.
Starve me, not giving I much choice. To do. South African fear.